Shalom, and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio, brought to you by the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky. This show is for Shabbat Parshat Vayigash, and it is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 5th of both Tevet and Lahavdil, January. This month, the dates are synchronized, an event that's roughly every 2.5 years, and which has, I am convinced, absolutely no significance. We'll be taking a parting look at Chanukah, and then we'll examine the concept of calendric proximity. If you've never heard of that phrase before, I can explain why. Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir ha-ma'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihiena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Ima vonot tishmor yah Adonai mi ya'amod. Ki imecha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim l'boker, shomerim l'boker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai ha-chesed, v'harbe imo fedut, v'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanatunim batzara uvashivya, ha'umidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachem aleihem v'yotziyem mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. I want to take a look back at Chanukah from a specific perspective. But before we do that, I would like to play one more Chanukah song. Not your standard Ma'oz Tzur or Nerli Nerli or Miyam Alel, but one that somebody called to my attention, and I downloaded it from the web. It's a song by Tom Lehrer. Kinda cute. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot for me. Those eastern winters, I can't endure 'em, so every year I pack my gear and come out here till Purim. Rosh Hashanah I spend in Arizona, and Yom Kippur way down in Mississippi. But in December, there's just one place for me. Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah like a baby in his cradle. I'll be playing with my dreidel, spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea. I'm spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica, wearing sandals, lighting candles by the sea. I spent Shavuos in East St. Louis, a charming spot, but clearly not the spot for me. Those eastern winters, I can't endure 'em, so every year I pack my gear and come out here till Purim. Rosh Hashanah I spend in Arizona, and Yom Kippur way down in Mississippi. But in December, there's just one place for me. Amid the California flora, I'll be lighting my menorah like a baby in his cradle. I'll be playing with my dreidel. Here's the Judas Maccabeus. Boy, if he could only see us spending Hanukkah in Santa Monica by the sea.
That was Tom Lehrer, and now we know where he spends most of the Jewish holidays. I don't think he mentioned his Pesach plans, but he did tell us about Chanukah, and that was the point. And I would like to say something about Chanukah in retrospect. More accurately, it's about not Chanukah. Just like we recently celebrated my grandson's 3rd birthday, and we gave his older brother a gift for his un-birthday and had to explain it to him. This is sort of like un-Chanukah, which I'd like to comment on. There's a well-known question of Chanukah, which I'm sure many listeners are familiar with. Based on the popular version of the Chanukah story, when the Chashmonaim found a one-day supply of oil, and it miraculously lasted 8 days, then the question says there are only 7 days of miracle. 1 day was normal. They found the one-day supply of oil. This is a famous question, as I said, and there is a book that contains 100 suggested answers, which culls rabbinic literature for quite a number of centuries, and other sources as well play with this question. Almost as fun as asking and answering is messing up someone else's answer and showing how yours is better. Not going to get into all of that now. Maybe next year, Amir Tzashem, at Hanukkah time. One of the answers is a particular favorite of mine, and it goes like this. There are 7 days of miracle that a one-day supply of oil lasted for 8 days, and there is one-day miracle that oil burns in the first place. In other words, nature is part of miracles, and it takes a miracle that steps outside nature for us to be reminded that nature itself is perhaps the greatest miracle or greatest collection of miracles that there is. Take a lemon, squeeze its juice out, put a wick in it, and try to light the wick. It won't burn, because the nature of lemon juice is that it doesn't burn. Take olives and squeeze their juice out, and they create a beautiful flame, which was part of the Beit HaMikdash service, and very much a part of Jewish life. This idea of recognizing nature as miraculous, it always brings to mind a short story by Anton Chekhov called The Bet, or The Wager. I won't go into the whole story, but one of the characters ended up in self-imposed solitary confinement without human contact for a period of 15 years. And at the end of that period, he was writing to the world some of his observations, some of the things that he learned during his period of isolation. He wrote, "The trouble with human beings is that if apple trees bore frogs, they would be amazed, but they don't know how to marvel that apple trees bear apples. Or orange trees, I don't even remember which it was now. The point is that if a tree were to bear frogs, that would be a wonder that is above or beyond or separate from nature. If a fruit tree bears fruit, that's to be expected. People take it for granted, although they shouldn't, because it is an amazing thing in this world that you can have a tree, that it could give fruit, that people could pick the fruit and enjoy them, and pick every single last fruit on the tree, and sure enough, next year, there it is again, same tree, hardly any expended labor, and the tree is full of fruit one more time. It might even be suggested that that's a greater miracle than bearing frogs, because frogs bearing frogs, that's a miracle too. So we don't even need apple trees to do that. That's besides the point. I hope you get the point. But here, let me put it in a different perspective, also from un-Chanukah. During 8 days of Chanukah, 3 times a day, 4 times on Shabbat and Rosh Chodesh, in the Amidah, plus however many Birkat HaMazons a person managed to say during Chanukah, we say the passage called Al Hanisim, and we acknowledge God for the miracles and wonders and victories and salvations which He has brought about in those days, in this time. And then we tell the story in the time of Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, Kohen Gadol. Chashmonai was the family name, Uvanav and his sons, when the Greeks stood up in order to destroy Torah and to take us away from our religion. And you, we say, God, in your mercy, stood by us in the time of our troubles. You fought our battles. You judged our judgments. You avenged us. And you turned over the great into the hands of the weak, and the many into the hands of the few, etc., etc. And we acknowledge all of these miracles. Then we continue with the Amidah, Va'al Kulam, and on all of the above, Yitborach v'yitromam Shimcha, may your name be blessed and exalted, Malkenu, our king, tamid l'olam v'ed, forever and ever. Now think about this for a moment. It sort of just dawned on me, this Chanukah. V'al Kulam, and for all of the above, we praise you, and we thank you. But that's not part of Al Hanisim. That's part of the mundane, every single day bracha of Modim Anachnu Lach. We inserted into that bracha a special passage for Chanukah, as we will do for Purim as well. But even without that insertion, when we are celebrating on Chanukah, meaning every day of the year, we say to God, thank you, and we acknowledge that you are our God forever and ever, the rock of our lives, our protector. We thank you for our lives. We thank you for the souls which you have given to us to take good care of. And we acknowledge your miracles, Shebechol Yom Imanu, the miracles that are with us every day. Va'al nifla'osecha v'tovotecha, and for the good things and the wonders, Shebechol eit, that in all time, erev v'voker v'tzoharayim, hatov ki lo chalu rachamecha, the goodness, and there is no end to your mercy, v'hamerachem ki lo tamu chasadecha, me'olam kivinu lach. V'al kulam, and for all of these, the daily miracles, the miracles of nature, your name shall be blessed and exalted forever. On Chanukah and on Purim, we sneak in the extra paragraph, and we detail the miracles associated with the particular holiday, but without it, we have plenty to thank God and acknowledge Him for miracles. You look at a dreidel and it says, Nes Gadol Haya Po, and for some of you listeners it still says, Nes Gadol Haya Sham. A great miracle happened here in Eretz Yisrael, there in Eretz Yisrael. But if you're following my point, there is a miracle, many, many miracles, to celebrate every single day of a person's life. That's what we mean when we get up in the morning and say, Mode ani lefanecha. And that's my post-Chanukah, un-Chanukah message. So many examples. We make a bracha on thunder and lightning. But every drop of rain is a wonder of creation. Not just the awesome display of thunder and lightning. We are human, and we respond to the flashy, pun intended, kind of display that lightning and thunder is. But rain and snow and wind are no less wonders of creation, wonders of God, miracles, each one on its own. And I've always believed that the challenge of Judaism, maybe the challenge of humanity, is to see the wonder of creation in everything that happens. Train of thought. Article in the news just yesterday about a school board in some state that voted to to reject that which they had already accepted previously as a proposal, to teach intelligent design as a possible alternative to the theory of evolution. And while admitting that the theory of evolution is severely flawed and has gaping holes that nobody can explain, the teaching of intelligent design, which is another way of saying a divine creator, was rejected by this school board as introducing religion in a public system, which is against the principles of the United States. It's not scientific. It's religious in nature. It's biblical, intelligent design. I can't help feeling that we'd be in a lot better shape if we would accept the notion of intelligent design and a creator in this world and not always have to find theories to fit everything that happens. But that's a whole other discussion, which we won't get into now. Let me move on or back to this Shabbat, specifically Motzoi Shabbat. Saturday night will be an excellent time, weather permitting, for Kiddush Levana. Those of us who follow what is known as Minhag Yerushalayim, based on the Minhagim, the practices of the Vilna Gaon and others, say Kiddush Levana from 3 full days, 72 minutes after the Molad, the new moon, as announced by our tradition. Specifically, the Molad, which 2 weeks ago we announced would be the following Shabbat early in the morning, 1 o'clock-ish. If you count from this past Shabbat, 1 o'clock, to Sunday, 1 a.m., Monday, Tuesday, 1 a.m., that meant that the first opportunity, according to the 3-day Minhag, was Tuesday night, and Tuesday night I did have an opportunity to say Kiddush Levana to a clearly visible and unobstructed moon. The following night, Wednesday, it was cloudy in the evening. I don't think anyone in Yerushalayim had an opportunity for Kiddush Levana. Of course, I didn't check the weather patterns in other places around the world, but during this time of the year, one really should take every opportunity, any opportunity that presents a clear view of the moon, to say Kiddush Levana and not necessarily wait for Motzoi Shabbat, which is the preferred time to say Kiddush Levana. Again, Minhag Yerushalayim does not tell you to wait for Motzoi Shabbat. It says 3 full days after the Molad, go for it. Ein machmitzin al ha-mitzvot. Mitzvah habol yodcha al tachmitzena. You don't let a mitzvah that you have an opportunity to perform, don't let it sit without performance. But most of the world, first of all, waits 7 days. That will be this coming Motzoi Shabbat, Parshat Vayigash. And because it's Motzoi Shabbat, it's an ideal time. This is so because Kiddush Levana is considered Kabbalat Penei Hashchina, going out to receive the divine presence. And when one is dressed and perfumed from Shabbat, both physically as well as spiritually, it is a particularly appropriate time to say Kiddush Levana. One way or the other, if you've already said it this month, fine. If not, check this Motzoi Shabbat, a very good time to say it, early enough in the month that if you don't have the opportunity, you'll have others, hopefully, late enough in the month to satisfy all the opinions. And as I've said many, many times, Kiddush Levana is a very special bracha, a very special ceremony, and part of that is our plugging ourselves into the wonders of nature. And therefore it fits in light of what I was saying earlier, that these are the everyday occurrences, sunrise, sunset, moon going through its phases. That's what we say in the bracha, an acknowledgement not of a flashy wonder of creation, but of the mundane, that the sun and the moon function day in and day out, day and night. Shelo yishanu et tafkidam. They don't change their function, and they seem to eagerly carry out the desire of their creator, as we should too. That was Simen Tov U'Mazel Tov, which is from Kiddush Levana, this particular version from an album called Sameach at the Wheel 2. You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio, coming to you from the OU Israel Center in Jerusalem. More to come. Over the last several weeks, I've been using Eitz Chaim as the opening song, rather than Simcha, which you just heard and are hearing under these words, which I had used for many, many years, a song played by Roman Kunstman, Zichrono Livracha, a very special friend. But Eitz Chaim, he has always been a very special song with me. In fact, it's a song I had wanted for my very first show about 8 years ago, and in Torah Tibbetz Audio, I ended up with an Eitz Chaim, but not the one I wanted, so I decided to go back to that as the opener. But for the second part of the show, I'm using a piece of Simcha, and I just wanted to share something with you unrelated to the Parshat HaShavua. Somebody found this very nicely calligraphied and mounted on a piece of cardboard. As I look closer, I think it's not calligraphied, but it's a nice font, a calligraphy font, but the sentiment is very nice. A friend is someone who knows the song in your heart and can sing it back to you when you have forgotten the words. A friend is someone who knows the song in your heart and can sing it back to you when you have forgotten the words. I like it. I hope you do too. Let's get back to a focus on the Sedra, and let me introduce you to the title of the lead tidbit in the hard copy of Torah Tidbits this week, a phrase which I coined, and I really have to check on the internet to see if anyone else has used it before, but I call it calendric proximity. It's an idea which is not that much of an innovation, but it goes like this. Different events, especially events which we commemorate either with holidays or fast days, or events that are recorded in Torah or in Tanakh, have a chronological sequence, and then they have another sequence. Chronological sequence is when did they actually happen? This event happened then, and 250 years later, something else happened. And 600 years after that, a different event occurred, etc., etc. That's chronological. But there is also a sequence based on the Jewish calendar, based on Parshat HaShavua and its relationship to the calendar, which takes events that did not necessarily happen at the same time and puts them together. For example, the calendric proximity of the story of Yosef and his brothers and the Hanukkah story is significant, even though the events happened 1,400 years apart from each other. What happens is the calendar threw them together, brought them into close proximity, and we see them as part of a new sequence for us, almost ignoring the chronological difference in time, because this is how we learn it, this is how we review it, this is how it's presented to us, and therefore we think in terms of a connection. So too, the fact that Asara B'Tevet follows on the heels of Chanukah and follows the story of Yosef and his brothers creates a situation where we see them as some kind of sequence. For example, in the middle of the tenure of the second Beit HaMikdash, roughly the middle, 200 years from the beginning, 200 years to go, we have the Chanukah story, where the kingdom was restored and some sense of autonomy was restored to the Jewish people for a period of 200 years to the destruction of the Second Temple. Comes Asara B'Tevet a week after Chanukah, and we sort of say, well, wait a minute, the events marked by the 10th of Tevet happened towards the end of the tenure of the first Beit HaMikdash. We're talking 200 years earlier. Well, for our purposes, the beginning of the siege around Jerusalem at the time of the Babylonians, which led to the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, is easily put out of place, out of sequence, and we can relate to it in terms of the destruction of the second Beit HaMikdash. There's nothing wrong with that, and a person is not supposed to say, well, wait a minute, this is anachronistic. Yes, it is, from a chronological perspective. But calendric, looking at the calendar, we can't but help overlook the technicality of when the events actually happened, and see that following the Chanukah story, which was a high point in Jewish history, it is followed so soon after the events that led to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. That's in our way of thinking. And we're not deluding ourselves by mixing up the times. We're saying that the calendar threw them together, and when you look at your calendar page, and at the beginning of the month of Tevet, you have Rosh Chodesh inside Chanukah and the second day and sometimes the third day. And then you have, if it's a good calendar, marked events for the 8th of Tevet and the 9th of Tevet and the 10th of Tevet. Then we take them and we examine them and we relate to them in the perspective of the calendar. Calendric proximity. just to look at it slightly differently, which not different, but it sort of adds to this. There are four fast days that commemorate the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. All four relate to the first Beit HaMikdash. Two of them are associated with the second Beit HaMikdash also. So if Tisha B'Av becomes the commemoration of the destruction of both Beit HaMikdash, and if Shivasar B'Tammuz is considered to be the anniversary of the breach of Jerusalem prior to the destruction of both Beit HaMikdash, technically we have sources that say that it was the 9th of Tevet, of Tammuz, in the second Beit HaMikdash, but we lump it together in Shivasar B'Tammuz, the 17th of Tammuz, and it doesn't make a difference that it's a different day. It's a matter of proximity that shows us events and allows us to relate to one in the background or in the proximity of the other. The Chanukah story was not followed by "and they lived happily ever after." There were problems with the Hasmonean kingdom. There was the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash, followed by a long period of exile, which we still are suffering now. Yet Chanukah is Chanukah, and no one voted Chanukah out because it didn't have a happily ever ending. It just allows us to put a perspective on things. Milchemet Achim, clash of brothers. Definitely a main theme of Yosef and his brothers that we read in Parshat HaShavua. Definitely a facet of Chanukah, which we tend to not focus on, but it's there, the fact that they were Jews who Hellenized, and they were Jews who remained faithful to their tradition, and there was internal clashes that are reminiscent of those that are part of pre-Chanukah. So mixing up times doesn't delegitimize looking at something a certain way, all because of calendric proximity. So here are some of the mishmash that comes out of this. The tension and friction between Yosef and his brothers manifests itself many years later in the split of the kingdom into Malchut Yehuda and Malchut Yisrael, the northern kingdom of Israel and Judea. This very much relates to the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash because of the first exile of the 10 tribes and then later of other people, and it was fragmented in different times, but it's all part of the same. And if the 9th of Tevet is the anniversary of the death of Ezra and Nehemiah, the two people instrumental in the attempt at return to Zion, the attempt at restoration of Torah life to the Jewish people who had sorely departed from that, then that becomes part of the whole picture. As I'm listening to myself speak, I probably am being perceived a little too vague and wishy-washy, but I hope you get the idea anyway, and it gives you something to think about. Getting back to Vayigash, and it continues into Vayechi, you have a reconciliation of the brothers, but it's not complete, and the problems continue. The brothers don't seem to ever have been convinced that Yosef really forgave them. So where do we look? You look into the Haftarah, the Haftorah of Vayigash, and you find a projection of events and prophecies superimposed over the Parsha. That's really one of the things the Haftorah does. And at the end you have Hayom Mishkani Alehem, my tabernacle, my tent, my sanctuary will be over them. Vayiti Lahem Lelokim, and I will be their God. Vehema Yehiuli La'am. These are promises and prophecies made in the Torah, but they are echoed here by the Navi Yecheskel, talking about the time of the future Geula, when the disparate parts of the Jewish people will unify, when Torah will be restored as the way of life to all Jewish people, and when Jewish people will return to Eretz Yisrael. Then v'yad'u hagoyim, even the nations will know, ki ani Hashem mekadesh et Yisrael, that I, God, sanctify the people of Israel, b'hiyot mikdashi b'tocham le'olam, when my sanctuary, my mikdash, will be among them forever. There's your prophecy and promise of, and they lived happily ever after, and we lived happily ever after, but it doesn't happen so quickly, and it certainly doesn't happen yet. At the end of the Sedra is the realization that we're in Mitzrayim, and we're not getting out so soon. Vayeshev Yisrael be'eretz Mitzrayim be'eretz Goshen. We grew mightily in numbers, and it's going to be a while till we get out of Egypt, and a lot of hard stuff in the meantime. But the Haftorah gives us that hope for the future. What I'm trying to say is taking events that happened with Mechirat Yosef and the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash and the return by Ezra and Nehemiah and the Hanukkah story, and rolling them into one is one important way in which we see things, and hopefully we will rise to the challenge and hasten the fulfillment of the prophecy at the end of the Haftorah of Vayigash. To a track from an album called Class One. Very nice collection from different composers. This track is called Eshet Chayil. Moshe Laufer, Eli Laufer, Yoni Shlomo. Eshet Chayil.
Shalom, oh, yes, oh,
In the Parsha, Yosef seems exceedingly driven to carry out the scene so that the dreams that he originally told his brothers will come to full fruition. And he does not reveal himself immediately. Beginning of the Seder, you have a very dramatic encounter between Yehuda and the not-yet-revealed Yosef. At the end of Miketz, the brothers seem to be resolved to their fate. They were accused of stealing the cup, the silver cup of the leader of Egypt, second in command, the viceroy, Yosef. And they were so taken aback by the accusation that they made a rash offer. You find it with any of us, put to death the guy you find it with, and the rest of us will be your slaves. The magnanimous Yosef says, Chas v'sholom, chalila li me'asod zot, I wouldn't do that. The person who we find the cup in his possession, he will be my servant, and you will return to your father in peace. Not a problem. Yehuda, in this sedra, takes his life into his hands and approaches the leader and pleads before him to allow Binyamin to return to Yaakov. And you can tell things are getting to Yosef because he has to keep going into private and crying, washing his face and come back out, but determined to keep this thing going until he reveals himself to the brothers. The Alshich, well-known commentary on Chumash, points out the following. Yehuda always sensed that bad things were going to happen to the brothers because of what they did to Yosef. And when they face disgrace and accusations and slavery and even death, he philosophically attributes this to divine punishment for what they did. But when this leader of Egypt says only the culprit will be taken as a slave and the rest of you will be free to go, and when he realizes that it is Binyamin who's the one who will remain as a slave, the one who did not participate in the sale of Yosef, and all the other brothers who would have been guilty are free to go, and he knows there's something else at work here. And that's why he turns from the meek lamb awaiting slaughter at the end of Miketz to the lion that he is, Gur Aryeh Yehuda, in confronting Yosef. I always found it sad that Yosef has to keep reassuring the brothers that he's not going to take things out on them. He's very philosophical about it. He said, this is God's plan, and you are just pawns in it. Of course, it's important to note that that does not exonerate the brothers for what they did. I have a sefer called Medrash Pelea, Wondrous Midrashim, and one that jumped off the page and smacked me between the eyes is the following. Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'Bnei Yisrael, God says to the people of Israel, you sold your brother into slavery. I swear by your lives that every single year you will say, Avadim Hayinu L'Faro B'Mitzrayim, we were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. You want to say anything else about Shibud Mitzrayim, the oppression and the enslavement in Egypt, I think you have to say that it is punishment for Mechirat Yosef. So then what is Yosef saying when he says to the brother, so what does Yosef mean when he says, and now, Lo atem shlachtem oti hena, you didn't send me here to Egypt, ki ho Elokim, it was God. Vayisimeni le'av le'faro, he was the one who put me into this high position relative to Paro, ula'adon l'chol beito, and as a master of all his house, Umoshel b'chol eretz Mitzrayim, and a leader in the land of Egypt. Does that take away any of the guilt that the brothers should have been feeling? To make a short job of the answer, a person is responsible for his actions. If they are good actions, he'll be rewarded for them. If they are bad actions, he'll be punished for them. That they are part of God's plan goes without saying. Or not. Maybe we have to keep saying it. So here is an example of God's plan, and the brothers played right into it. But that does not excuse what they did. Different levels of operation are here. We have to understand that God is running the show. We don't understand what he does and why he does it, but he is the boss. I guess if a person says, I tried my best to do the right thing, but look what happened, and I feel terrible, look what happened. No, you tried the best you could, and that's what you're supposed to do. It happened because it was supposed to happen. So don't kill yourself about it if you did the right thing. But here, they didn't. So I don't really have a good answer to that, but I don't have to have a good answer now, because the time for Torah Tidbits audio is slowly running out, and I'm going to have to say Shabbat Shalom shortly and let you ponder that question. And if you come up with something, let me know. Write to me at tt@ou.org, and if I come up with something interesting, I will be sure to share it with you in an upcoming show. In the meantime, let's take another look at a couple of points in Vayigash, and we'll sum it up. The book of Shemot, Parshat Shemot, begins, Ve'ele Shemot b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayma, and in Parshat Vayigash, two sedras earlier, we find the same words, Ve'ele Shemot b'nei Yisrael haba'im Mitzrayma, Yaakov uvanav, Bechor Yaakov Reuven. In Vayigash, we have the full count of the 70 souls that came down to Egypt, that went down to Egypt, alive. In Shemot, it's Vayamat Yosef v'chol echav v'chol hador ha'u. Joseph and the whole generation were gone already, but they're counted again. And Rashi makes the comment there. But let's take a look at the count in this week's Seder of Vayigash. First observation, which strikes me every time I see it in the Chumash, and it's several places, the identification of Bechor Yaakov Reuven. Reuven, even though he messed up several times, he messed up in Mechirat Yosef, he was supposed to go back and save Yosef, didn't work out. He offered to kill his own sons, or that his own sons would be put to death if anything happened to Binyamin. And Yaakov must have given him this look. He basically lost the three elements that could have been his, at least some of them. The kingship went to Yehuda. The Kahuna and Leviah went to Levi. And the kingship, I said that already, and the Bechor, the double portion of the Bechor, went to Yosef. And yet, Reuven, and he did a terrible thing, which the Torah described in very serious language, yet he is continuously referred to by his correct title, Bechor Yaakov Reuven. So that's the first observation. Then the Torah goes through each of the sons of Yaakov, and the children, and occasionally grandchildren that they had. Interesting, in the list of Shimon's children, Yimuel, Yamin, Ohad, Yachin, Tzohar, v'Shaul ben Hakna'anit. Shaul ben Hakna'anit, some of the commentaries say that he was the son of Dinah. Rashi says she's referred to as a Kanaanite because she had become pregnant from Shechem, the Kanaanite, and that Shimon raised Shaul as his own. I'm just making different comments about the list of the names. Under Yehuda's children, Er and Onan, who had died still in Canaan and are not counted among the 70 people who came to Mitzrayim, nonetheless are mentioned in the Pasuk, in addition to Shelah, Peretz, and Zerach. Among the sons of Yisachar is one that is identified as Yov, very similar to the Greek god Jove. And there are commentaries who point to later in the Torah, when the families are named and the sons of the Shvatim are named, he's called Yishuv. A shin was added to his name. Commentaries say that the name Yov was the name of a pagan god and should not have been used to name one of the children, one of the grandchildren of Yaakov Avinu. And sort of as a reprimand to Yisachar, a shin was added to the name Yov to give Yishuv, and the shin was left in the name Yisachar, but is not pronounced. In other words, Yisachar is spelled Yud, Sin, Sin, Kaf, Resh, but it's pronounced not Yisachar, but Yisachar, and the reproach is learned from that. Then you have a summary of the descendants of Leah, for including Dinah, gets special mention, and a total of 33. What's noteworthy about that is if you actually count, you find only 32. So Rashi says the 33rd one, who is not mentioned in the Psukim, but our tradition says that Yocheved, daughter of Levi, was born as the people were going down to Egypt on the border of Canaan and Egypt, and she is the counted as the 33rd. Another possibility is that Yaakov himself was counted among the 33, although we usually don't count Yaakov among the 70 souls that went with Yaakov. Following the children of Leah, we have the children of Zilpah, who is attached to Leah. So you have the children of Gad and the children of Asher, including another female that was counted among the 70, namely Serach bat Asher. That means that Dinah bat Yaakov and Serach bat Asher are two females among the 70 souls, possibly Yocheved is a third, and that's it. All the rest are male. Therefore, it's noteworthy. And after delineating the children of Gad and Asher, the Torah says, Ela b'nei Zilpah, Asher natan lavan lilayavito. These are the descendants of Zilpah, but Zilpah was a maiden that was given by Lavan to Leah to go with her, and therefore they're counted a total of 16, counted on its own, but if you add to the 33, you get 49. Then, B'nai Rachel Eshet Yaakov, these are the descendants of Rachel, wife of Yaakov. This too is very noteworthy, for none of the others does it say, and these are the descendants of X, the wife of Yaakov. For Leah, you have Reuven is the Bechor, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, Yisachar, and Zevulun, a total of 33, and it's Ela B'nei Leah. These are the descendants of Leah, who gave birth to them to Yaakov, through Yaakov, or whatever you want to define that is, but not this statement, which is exclusively for Rachel, B'nei Rachel, Eshet Yaakov. She was his first love. She was the purpose of all of it. And who are they? Yosef and Binyamin. Yosef, even though he went down earlier, is counted among the people who came down with Yaakov. And even his two sons, who were born in Egypt, are numbered among the 70, and that's significant as well. Yosef's wife is mentioned here, Asenat bat Potipherah, Kohen On, And that's unique because none of the other wives of the sons of Yaakov are named. Again, all I'm doing is making observations as we go through the list. And anybody that wants to open up a Chumash to chapter 46 in Bereshit, beginning with Pasuk 8, Mem Vav Chet, can follow along. After Yosef, with Ephraim and Manasseh, are counted, and Asenath is mentioned, you then have the children of Binyamin, 10 of them, Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Geira, Naaman, Echi, Rosh, Mupim, Chupim, and Ard. I've always thought that Mupim and Chupim must be twins, but that's just because of the choice of names. Commentaries, as far as I know, don't bear that out. So don't take that similar to the other comments. Bnei Rachel, the descendants of Rachel, who bore children to Yaakov, number 14. Then we go to Bilha, Bnei Dan Chushim, one child for Dan, even though the plural is used, Uvnei Dan, and Bnei Naphtali, 1, 2, 3, 4, the total from Bilha, who Lavan gave to Rachel, is 7. That's it, and then the verse gives us a total, Kol HaNefesh HaBa'al LeYaakov Mitzrayma, Yotzei Yerecho, all the descendants of Yaakov who came down to Egypt, Milvad Neshei V'nei Yaakov, not counting the wives, who really are not descendants of Yaakov. Kol Nefesh, Shishim Vashesh, total 66. And B'nei Yosef, Asher Yulad V'Mitzrayim Nefesh Shnayim. B'nei Yosef, who were born in Egypt at the time, were 2, Ephraim and Manasseh. And then if you add Yosef, it's a third. The 66 plus 3 should give you 69. But the way the Torah says it, Kol HaNefesh Levet Yaakov HaBa'a Mitzrayma Shivim. And from there, you can imply or infer that Yaakov was included, which would leave Yocheved off the list. You really have either way to go on that. And that's about it for this week's Torah Tidbits audio. We'll finish with a song, another track from the Class 1 album. And it leaves me just enough time. I shouldn't really say that since I'm not hemmed into a fixed schedule here. But I can say, have a Shabbat Shalom and Lehishtameah. And enjoy. Before I put on the track Nishmat Kol Chai with the opening words of that prayer from Shabbat morning Shacharit, I want to say one other thing. Back in the beginning of Vayeshev, you had Vayeshev Yaakov Be'eretz Megurei Aviv Be'eretz Kena'an. Yaakov was settling down in Eretz Yisrael. But his sons clashed with each other, fought with each other, and the unspeakable Mechirat Yosef took place. That sort of ruined the life of the brothers and of Yaakov. Comes the end of Vayigash, and we know that the people are in Mitzrayim, and we know ahead that they're going to be there for quite some time. Yet the brothers are reconciled, and somehow you feel that even though they're in Mitzrayim, there is hope for them as a family and a nation, because they're together again, even though they're not in Eretz Yisrael yet. And it's a while. It will be quite a while until Yehoshua takes them into Eretz Kena'an to settle, to conquer and settle the land. In the meantime, they're in Mitzrayim, but they're a family. Just something else to think about. Here is, from Class 1, the track Nishmat Kol Chai.
maskol chai tevore Esimcho Hashem Elokeinu Veruach kol boso tefore Zichrecho malkeinu tomir Mishem maskol chai tevore Esimcho Hashem Elokeinu Veruach kol boso tefore Zichrecho malkeinu tomir מי שמסגור חי תבורא לשמחו השם אלוקינו ורוח כל בוסו תפואר זכרכו מלכינו תמיד מי שמסגור חי תבורא לשמחו השם אלוקינו ורוח כל בוסות אפואר זכרכו מלכנו תומים מנוי לא Oh, no.